dialogue. Dialogue, a presentation of the Public Affairs and Special Events Department of KLRB News.
This is Dialogue Assassination with political research specialist Mae Brussel. And for KLRB-FM, I'm Phil Kogan. We're glad you could join us again this afternoon for another edition of Dialogue Assassination. Mae, you know, there just isn't enough humor in Dialogue Assassination.
Not this week
and not too often. Although there you do throw a few jokes in once in a while. They're political jokes, though. Most of the jokes are names, really. But there was a story this week which I saved just for Dialogue Assassination. And I just briefly, it's just a few lines. Officials in the offices of Vice President Spiro Agnew and the governor of Maine are trying to uncover the facts behind a mysterious bedspread. Agnew has returned a bedspread which he says was sent as a gift from the governor of Maine. He said he couldn't accept it because Governor Kenneth Curtis supported anti-war demonstrators who pelted Agnew's car with food in Augusta, Maine recently. But Curtis today issued a denial, shall we say, a blanket denial, saying he never sent any bedspread, so how could Agnew reject it? Curtis, a liberal Democrat, says he has never sent Agnew anything, and quoting now, "nor do I intend doing so." So the great blanket controversy, a little light news for Dialogue Assassination. Now we'll go downhill. Yeah.
Now we have to find some meaning in that article, that bedspread, right?
Where was that bedspread during the Kennedy assassination, and why was it sent to Agnew?
Maybe that was a bedspread that smothered J. Edgar Hoover.
Well, in all seriousness, Mae, let's get in. What are we going to be covering in this this hour? What does Dialogue Assassination do?
We're going to talk about the conspiracy that exists in the United States to tighten the control of the powers. I talk about the political assassinations of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and the evidence of the political murders throughout our country and in the states and local area is all tying together now. The tightening of the police state has not very many threads to be wound up and cast off to make the garment. And I think we'll talk today not on the evidence of the research of the John Kennedy murder, because, you know, that was the bulk of my research where I began in 1963. But we'll talk about things in the news that affect that particular assassination, comment about it. And then we're going to talk about a section of the police state, namely Patrick Gray III. Last Saturday when we met, we talked about the death of J. Edgar Hoover. In the past week, I have collected some information on Patrick Gray III that I want to share with you, because when I talk about conspiracies and assassinations, it's difficult in 1 hour to make a whole network, a thought tie together, bringing in all my research. But I do have about 1,800 subjects in my filing cabinet that contain various parts of the overthrow of the government, how it is overthrown, and someday I'd like to just read the titles for 1 hour of the various envelopes. But under the FBI now, the new director, I have a new envelope called Patrick Gray III, but I pulled from other articles filed under Los Angeles Police Department and under the killing of Ruben Salazar and other information. I'll give you a brief biography. We'll jump around other subjects, but I want to talk about him first.
Maybe you should identify Patrick Gray III.
Okay, Patrick Gray III is the new temporary appointment of President Richard Nixon to the FBI to succeed J. Edgar Hoover. He didn't waste much time making that selection, and he said it was a temporary appointment until after the elections. But by the biography of this man, he is a shoo-in, and those people write a lot of serious letters. And listen closely to what I'm saying. I hope people have their cassettes and tapes out or their pencils, and make a few notes, because I want to talk about Mr. Gray first. The New York Times had an article saying that the new director is not to be political. Nixon says he wants a non-political FBI man. Well, we'll discuss that in various aspects. I have a section in my filing cabinet called Agnew, Not Political, or The Men That Overthrew Greece, Not Political, and Richard Helms, Not Political, the head of the Central Intelligence Agency. Phil always brags, I'm not a political person. I'm not a Republican or Democrat. If you read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, or The History of Germany and the Growing of the Clandestine Government, or the description of Reinhard Gehlen in the three new books that are out on Reinhard Gehlen, he always said, I'm not political. He's very firm. Reinhard Gehlen was the chief of Eastern Intelligence under Adolf Hitler, and he helped form the clandestine government after World War I that eventually put Hitler into power. And when World War II was over, he met with Alan Dulles, even before the war was over, in Switzerland, and came to the conclusion that he could help us use their espionage system that the Nazis had used in all of Europe. And he helped form, we had the OSS, which was our intelligence agency, that became the CIA. Reinhard Gehlen set up the whole intelligence system with the help of Alan Dulles. The two worked together, and Richard Helms was their protege. He was over in Germany, in Nazi Germany. He was in Switzerland, and he prides himself that he's not political, and Reinhard Gehlen is not political. And the new man who is taking over the FBI is a non-political person, and that word is important, because I have watched for 4 years the squeezing of the FBI by the CIA to push it in disrepute and out of power. Remember, we talked about it last week. So getting this particular man into this position, and we'll go into his background, the very fact that he's not political is dangerous. There was an article by Representative Don Edwards this week in Congress saying that Patrick Gray was practically unheard of in Washington. He was number two man in the Justice Department, but this appointment came as a surprise. He wasn't in the FBI at all. And it's interesting that the normal succession of power, like when Greece was overthrown or in any military coup, is not done by the people next in line. An unknown takes over, and he's been ready for that part for many, many years.
He's got a smiling picture there in the New York Times. He's a pretty friendly-looking guy.
Yes, he's a very friendly... there isn't one German that you look at the Nuremberg trial that didn't look just as normal or human, so you can't go by that. In order to be not political, his wife Beatrice said that she'd stop working for the committee to reelect the president. She said to President Nixon in the White House, does that mean I have to stop working? He said, you have to stop this minute. It has to be not.
Very commendable. I wonder whether the Nixon reelection organization will miss her.
I don't know if they'll miss her. John Towers' reelection office in Texas was burned this week, $1 million worth of campaign papers. He says that'll affect his election down there. Maybe the election offices should be shaken up. But he said to her, you have to resign right away.
So Patrick Gray's wife is out of politics.
Yes, because her husband has a non-political position. Now, another clandestine relationship between Patrick Gray and Richard Nixon is described in the fact that Richard Nixon was a close friend of Hoover's, that they shared, Hoover visited his home at San Clemente or Key Biscayne, and they went to the racetracks together. But Mr. Gray's relationship to Richard Nixon is, in quotes, professional. And I'll show you what he means by that.
Yeah, I wish you would.
Okay. Now, he says he's has no problem taking over. He says it'll be very easy to do, and he'll be in charge of the dossiers and files. And he says, I'm perfectly, thoroughly qualified. I have 8,600 experts in the Bureau to help me. My forte is managerial ability, and he's ready to go to work. He says he's not an arch conservative. He'd like to be described as a human being. Once more, you have to read the history of Nazi Germany to appreciate that.
Now, he says that President Nixon wants the FBI to be non-political. No. That implies that in the past it's recognized to be political, right?
Well, I would say that in the terms that J. Edgar Hoover was certainly lined up with the arch-conservatives. But there's a fine line between an arch-conservative and a police state agent. You see, Spiro Agnew doesn't do any fundraising and never did at any Republican parties. He goes to Air Force bases. The old guard Republicans have nothing to do with Spiro Agnew or Richard Nixon. They don't even mingle with the arch Republicans. They go to certain important people's places and military bases, and the campaign is run differently than the old Goldwater days when there was an election, or Eisenhower, when they went among the streets and raised money and had luncheons at the party. These men are beyond the party, above it, and they're not, in the strict sense, Republicans. They are chosen agents to stand above the former political party system. If someday if you want, remind me, I'll bring in my envelope on Agnew, not a political person, and show you how it lines up with some of the names that I'm mentioning, how the Republican Party complains down there that he is not available at all, and he certainly isn't. I looked into my file on Patrick Gray because an article came out about him in the newspaper. There were a lot of them this week describing him. And the article that described Patrick Gray was telling about his position. He was telling about himself. And he said that he, when he was working in Washington, now he was not in the Justice Department. He was, remember that he was not in the Justice Department. He turns out to be from the National Security Council. And this is interesting. And when he was working in Washington, he was responsible for two very important cases. This is what the paper said this week. He figured prominently in two Justice Department shakeups. One was the resignation of Criminal Division Chief Will Wilson. Now, that's the man who was questioned in a tax scandal in Texas. They are not prosecuting Will Wilson because I'm sure bring in very many well-known men in Texas. They just said, you resign, you're head of the criminal division. But then Mr. Gray went on to said he requested the resignation of Robert L. Meyer, former U.S. attorney in Los Angeles. Now, I called Washington and spoke to Don Edwards' office. I sent a special delivery airmail letter. I said, are you familiar with the case of Mr. Meyer? And they were not familiar with that in Washington, and I sent out 119 letters on the background of Mr. Meyer. Mr. Meyer was the U.S. attorney who was appointed by Nixon in 1970. And in 1971, he was investigating the murders of various people in Los Angeles, Ruben Salazar, who was killed by a sheriff deputy, and he was investigating the murder of a black veteran named Jerry Lee Amay. And he was also looking into the Isla Vista riots. And these were very intense anti-black, anti-Chicano murders. They were stirring a lot of resentment in the community. And Mr. Meyer's position was to investigate these things and then also into the death of two other Mexican-American nationals in 1970. So he received a call. This is U.S. Attorney Robert Meyer, received a call from Washington, D.C., from the Nixon administration that demanded his retirement because he's not to investigate these cases. Mr. Meyer, I spoke to him on the phone. This was in 1972. In January, I called Robert Meyer down there. And his article in the newspaper said, the individual that called me indicated he was acting on instructions. And he enumerated hurriedly two or three matters in which I was involved. Well, if he was acting on instructions, his only boss had to be John Mitchell or Richard Nixon, because he's the second man in the Justice Department, according to the description of him. And if Richard Nixon or John Mitchell is calling off the investigation of Isla Vista, or Ruben Salazar, or Jerry Lee Amay, or the killing of other Mexicans down there, which I have labeled in my cross-filing system as political assassinations done by the Sheriff's Department, the Los Angeles Police Department. These are political conspiracies. The Isla Vista thing I've talked on the show before, and the same Special Enforcement Bureau that planned that Isla Vista riot and all the violence there was the same group that was in on the Manson, the Sharon Tate thing. And I called Robert Meyer about his being fired, and he said, I only was doing what I was supposed to do. And he did say in print, and I have a copy here, that he was investigating these racial problems of cold-blooded murder in the Los Angeles Police Department. He did have four policemen charged in one of these instances, and they were acquitted, and then two other policemen were brought in, and they closed that case, they said, because of lack of evidence after the investigation. Well, Washington wanted those cases, if Nixon is interested in the black or the Mexican-American or assassination squads in Los Angeles or in justice, he's telling you where his head is at. And this Gray, who's to be the head of the FBI now, called off those investigations. Now, I have another article here on Ruben Salazar. He is one of the men that Robert Meyer was investigating. And this was published in October 1970. And it's by R.E. Maxon.
Where was this published?
This was in the L.A. Free Press. And it was done by R.E. Maxon. It says, was Ruben Salazar working on an expose of law enforcement at the time of his mysterious death? He was murdered by sheriffs in cooperation with unknown authorities. The East L.A. riot was intentionally provoked by the sheriffs for the purpose of providing them with a cover to make the murder of Salazar.
should maybe indicate that Salazar was a very respected reporter for the Los Angeles Times at the time of his death.
That's right. Reuben Salazar worked for the Los Angeles Times. Then he left them. I think at the time of his death, he was doing expose of the police department. And if I read one paragraph of what he was doing, this expose exists, and I hope that we can get in touch with the people who have it and get this published in a book form. The expose that Salazar had completed, not that he was working on, was described in the September issue of the Los Angeles Free Press. It said he alluded to the interlocking secret agreement and the file-sharing practices of the Central Intelligence Agency, the Army, the FBI, the California Attorney General, and local police authorities. The interlocking relationship. You see, this is why Robert Kennedy could be killed in Los Angeles, and people are told Sirhan did it when he didn't do it. The covering up of that murder, of hiding the people who did the crime, framing Sirhan as a patsy. There's an interlocking relationship in the city of Los Angeles and all these assassination squads and murders that are taking place of the CIA, the Army, the FBI, the California Attorney General, and local police authority. He also expressed the belief that no meaningful investigation could be conducted into Salazar's death because these agencies would never cooperate and thereby expose their secret alliance. You see, this was in 1970 that Mr. Maxson is saying nobody could ever go into the opening of Salazar's death. He mentions that Salazar was killed from a weapon specifically prohibited in most of these situations, and that the sheriffs lied like hell, and that Salazar had received death threats from the law enforcement officials before his death. And the prediction was that nobody could ever go into the story of his death. So when U.S. Attorney Robert Meyer is going into the question of Reuben Salazar's death at a serious level, like a U.S. attorney should do, then Patrick Gray III calls from Washington and says, stop that, you're fired. You're fired. And that man is the head of the Federal Bureau of Investigation right now.
Now, Salazar died during riots or disturbance in East Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And the circumstances of his death were never really too clear. They were recognized from the beginning as being somewhat strange because he was known to most of the officers as a reporter, and he wasn't throwing rocks or anything. He was leaving a building or something.
Yeah, that's right. And the article concluded that just as bad in recent years have we seen an alarming increase in secret files of information kept by local and federal agencies, secret files that go to record citizens' expressions of lawful dissent. And because of modern computer technology, these files are much more thorough than those of Nazi Germany ever were. And it was largely through the use of such files that Nazism was able to come to power so swiftly in Germany and maintain its power so completely. We talk all the time about the comparisons between here and Nazi Germany. And you see, by killing Reuben Salazar, who had information on the links of Washington to California and the military, and this was in 1970, that was several years after the Robert Kennedy murder by the Los Angeles Police Department, or with their help, Salazar had to be killed. And the proof of the conspiracies I talk about is the fact that none of these things ever can go to trial. If an honest man comes, he's removed from office. If an honest attorney comes, if he's part of the system, he hides the evidence.
Sounds kind of hopeless, describing it like that.
Oh, it's pretty dismal. If you want to be really hopeless, should I read you the next article about Patrick Gray? Should I go on?
Is there any direct evidence that Gray did order the Salazar?
Oh, yes. Yeah. The Los Angeles Times article of May the 4th, that's this week, because Dialogue Assassination is the news of this week and goes to the past. I pull out from the older files different information about Patrick Gray, any person that you want that I have information on, I'll bring in. But the description of Henry when he became the head of the FBI this week said he was the Justice Department's number two head man, and that he was responsible. He requested the resignation of Robert L. Meyer, former U.S. Attorney General. But Robert Meyer, in 1972 in January, we're talking about May when they said he requested Robert Meyer's being fired.
Meyer explains why.
Then Meyer, earlier in January, 5 months earlier, said that his call from Washington, he doesn't mention Gray by name, he says from the Justice Department, said he's acting on instructions. Well, if he's the number two man in the Justice Department, it had to be John Mitchell or Richard Nixon who ordered the stopping of the investigation of those murders. Now, here's, you know...
Some more distressing news.
There's more distressing news on Robert Meyer, and I just happened to bring this in a few minutes before I came to see you. I've been cleaning out my filing cabinet, and this article is in February 1972, and I talked on one of the programs about several men that went before the Supreme Court to present cases, and one of them won, and he was very anxious to make it a... Well, it bothered me. This particular gentleman wanted to make it a crime to question the government at times of, like, a conspiracy thing. If you're against the government, it's treason to criticize the government. His name is William G. Hundley, a lawyer in the Justice Department, Internal Security Division. And he's been planning an argument before the Supreme Court on convictions for conspiring to overthrow the government. And that goes into something I want to talk about in a minute. You know, like, as we begin to criticize Nixon, if he makes himself commander-in-chief and the war escalates, then we can't continue these shows to criticize him. The contingencies are made by the Internal Security Division that by wanting Nixon removed, either by impeachment or trial for murder, we're overthrowing the government. But in the same court that day, there was a gentleman that appeared by the name of Patrick Gray III, who argued his first case in January 1972. He's a lawyer, but he took a case before the Supreme Court. And he found the experience he called intellectually challenging. He had spent 24 years in the Navy as a commander in a submarine and then was special assistant to the Secretary of Defense. He also was in the... Okay, you're frowning. I'm talking about a warfare state. But what Eisenhower warned us about, right, the military-industrial... As a civilian, he served on the personal staff of Richard Nixon in 1960. And he is now, when this article was written, in the Justice Department. Now, Gray went to the Supreme Court in January 1972 for his first, I guess, only appearance before the Supreme Court. And he spent 66 hours and 25 minutes in an argument. And the argument was this. He got up to the lectern with notes on the constitutionality of suspending disability benefit payments without a hearing. That was his case. That he argued to the Supreme Court on suspending disability benefit payments without having a hearing. Is that a police mentality? In other words, if you are hired by the federal government or any position where you don't... It takes away having to have a hearing if you are getting disability benefit payments and you talk about the government, if you're a career builder wounded in war and you're receiving checks from the government and you have the constitutional right to speak up against this particular government for any reason. This was his supreme moment at the Supreme Court.
What did he propose to substitute for the hearing, anything?
No, what he wanted to do was to do away with the contingency that you had to argue the reason for giving these people benefits. And the article went on to say he hoped to leave the justices with the impression that either here is a brazen bastard or one who knows the law. Now, he want, end quote, this writer, Ronald Ostrow of the Los Angeles Times, said his impression is to either say, I'm really a bastard or I know my constitutional law. He could be both. You know, it wasn't either or, he's both. He's a bastard and he knew his law. You know, he got up and argued this. But the comment of a writer in the Los Angeles Times, not some radical newspaper, was, this is really a bastard. So that is Patrick Gray, now head of our Justice Department. And there's another article in the New York Times written by Ronald Ostrow. Oh, I think it was the same one who did that other article on him, that he was such a bastard. Yeah. Patrick Gray III, and it goes into some more of his background, and I think it's important in terms of police state or conspiracies, because he says that Nixon appointed Gray. It was important at this period to have a man that he has confidence in. Well, that means that nobody else in the succession at the FBI he has any confidence in. He has to take a man who's been in the Defense Department and the National Security Council. This is his background. Defense Department, Navy, then Defense Department, National Security Council. So he wasn't picked for the FBI ranks. Nixon had a lot of confidence in Hoover, but he didn't have enough confidence to get a successor from the FBI ranks. He said he had been a friend of Nixon's for 25 years and met him in 1947. He worked for him in 1960 when Nixon was vice president on his personal staff, and he said his chores were non-political in nature. This, again, is another reference to his non-political posture with Richard Nixon. Now, Nixon was running against Kennedy in 1960, and this was a very important phase of the Cold War, whether the government would be turned over to this young Kennedy with all these new ideas, or whether the succession from the Eisenhower administration with Allen Dulles and John Foster Dulles controlling the State Department and intelligence agencies would keep control through Richard Nixon. So to say that what he did for Richard Nixon in 1960 was not political has to be a lie, because Nixon's been political all of his life, but that was the most important year of his life, you know. And so he says it was just non-political. What he said was that he just worked for the Defense Department, and he set up office space for lawyers in Washington. When Nixon lost the election, he was selected. He was out in California, and he was selected to go to John Mitchell's office, and there's a link there of connecting him with these large lawyers. And I wonder in the chain of command how important Patrick Gray III was in introducing him to John Mitchell. Richard Nixon didn't know Mitchell in those days. And Gray, in telling about his relationship to Nixon now, is saying that he was to set up contacts with these lawyers. And when Nixon lost, he began a whole new thing. When he lost the presidential election, he began realigning his whole head. It was after running for governor and he lost it, he moved east. But he said his job was as a management consultant. He met him when he was special assistant to the Secretary of Defense and attended the National Security Council. Now, Patrick Gray III, I believe, has to be part of the whole intelligence agency. I feel that the FBI building in Washington will be an extension of the CIA building in Virginia. I think that the initials may stay the same, but I don't feel that there's any difference now that the CIA will take over that whole complex. This man worked for the National Security Council and made a remark that was in the New York Times, said he observed the then vice president in action, as if he's looking over Nixon.
Has there ever been any doubt that the CIA and FBI were awfully close?
Well, I think that there's been a lot of feuding. You see, the FBI started long before the CIA in the 20s, right after World War I. And then the CIA began its own thing after World War II and began to bring in espionage agents from Germany. And we began our large contracts with Defense Intelligence Agency, Navy Intelligence, brought in Nazis and von Braun and the Space Agency. They brought in their whole intelligence system, which became greater than the FBI. The FBI was relegated to kidnappings and bank robberies, you see. And the competition's been very keen between the two agencies. And lately, about a year ago, the CIA began to cut off communication with the FBI and certain intelligence things. There's a lot of competition between them, you see. And J. Edgar Hoover is isolated over his racetrack friends, and we talked about that last week, the Mafia, the Syndicate, and the Prohibition Gang. You know, he was cut off from the large intelligence gathering that came after World War II. So Patrick Gray, he's talking now about his relationship to Richard Nixon, that he observed him. And I think that's dangerous that he has the position, the way he worded it, that he's watching Nixon. Now, Mr. Gray said that next week he'll have a meeting with his 59 agents. That's one from each state and all around, I suppose. And then they'll confer at a retreat outside Washington. And again, there's no reason why all the agents couldn't meet with him, and that the reshaping couldn't be public domain, the secrets. These retreats remind me of Hitler and his retreats. It's the same kind of clandestine behavior. And then he went on to say he hopes to have a real shredding down on all the issues. And I think that's a slip of the tongue. I think they'll do like ITT. He'll take that whole office and shred down a lot of things that are around.
Okay, this is Dialogue Assassination with political research specialist Mae Brussel. We'll continue after we identify the station. This is KLRB FM, Carmel, 24 hours a day.